Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once again we have another episode that sort of just appears to come from nowhere, almost out the blue, well, literally out the blue, in the case may be here with this guest, out of the blue. And sometimes you just kind of have to almost pinch yourself that who you're about to speak to and the subjects that you're about to discuss. Certainly for myself and certainly for the co-hosts. This is a player who just completely sits in the sweet spot of our footballing education, our footballing childhood. But before we introduce the special guest, first of all, the two co-hosts. First of all, I'll introduce the man who's responsible for arranging this interview, Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Stu. Really looking forward to this. We've got an incredible guest this evening.
It is. And when you sort of sent a tentative message just saying anybody interested, I think I probably gave it a good 5 or 6 seconds to let everyone else get their bidding first. And then I jumped all over it and was like, yeah, I am, trying to be all sort of cool about it and take my time. Yeah, I'm interested, Paul. Thinking, please let me be on.
Glad to have you here, Stu. Wouldn't be the same without you. You know that's the...
And second co-host, who I absolutely know, is going to be thinking of all the same things that I'm thinking about. Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Oh, how are we doing, Stu? This is going to be spectacular.
It is.
Yeah.
I was just about to say, it's one of these, isn't it, where it just, arguably, there's certainly no better game to discuss. There's no better moments to discuss. And probably there is no better sort of era to have a guest from that wouldn't appeal to us.
Oh, just completely within the sweet spot. I mean, for me and you, Shoes, particularly, I think we'd have swapped Paul's sticker on the playground many times over out of the Panini albums, most definitely. But yeah, completely within the sweet spot. Yeah, just massively looking forward to it.
To be fair, actually, now you've just mentioned that, I just thought that we should have a Panini sticker book of guests, of people that we've had. And this, to be fair, probably could be our debut of Panini sticker guests. Anyway, obviously enough of us, because clearly the most important person that's going to be doing the talking tonight, we need to introduce. So our guest this evening is Mr. Paul Power. Made his debut for his local side, Manchester City, against Aston Villa, 27th of August 1975. Went on to play an incredible total of 437 games for the club. His goal in the 81 FA Cup semi-final replay versus Ipswich took City to Wembley, where they're involved in, it actually is the most memorable final ever with Tottenham, certainly the replay. Malcolm Allison appointed him as club captain in 1979, a role he held until he left in 1986. Voted City's Player of the Year twice, also led his team to the final of the full Members' Cup in 86. Throughout his time at Main Road, was renowned for professionalism and distinction with which he captained the club. And he's still regularly chosen, and again, rightly so, by fans to be in any Manchester City all-time 11. He moved to Everton, which I guess is now where Paul McParland's interest starts to peak.
Indeed.
At the start of the 86-87 season, and played an integral part in their title win, also being chosen by their supporters as the club's Player of the Year. When he finished playing, became a first-team coach at Goodison Park before working with the PFA, then returning to Manchester City as an academy coach, where he was instrumental in ensuring that a certain young Mr. Phil Foden signed for the club. After leaving his role with City, relocated to Southwest France, this really is the perfect life, where he now resides. But anybody who grew up, as we've said, watching football in the 1970s and 1980s will always Remember, Paul, surging runs down the left flank, his determination to win, and we're all going to sit here and wonder how on earth he was never picked for England. Always led by example on and off the pitch. True embodiment of what it meant to be a local lad captaining the club that you supported. It truly is an honour to have such a giant of the footballing world as our guest today. Like I say, I can't wait to just listen. I'm not even sure I'm going to ask any questions. I think I'm going to ask the first question and just let it go, I think. But this guy's played for two of the biggest clubs in the country. And just to top it all off, when you couldn't think it could get any better, he also studied for a degree in law, which is good, actually, in case we say something, because sometimes we can get ourselves into trouble on here. But chose to make his case for the defence on the football field rather than in the legal chambers. Paul, welcome and thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. I hope I can live up to that really introduction, by the way.
I have absolutely no doubt. Just sometimes I feel like an incredibly lucky person and I have one of the best sort of jobs in the world. And this is one of those such occasions where you almost have to pinch yourself as to who I'm speaking to and who we're about to listen to. There's so many questions already. But to begin with, I suppose, you know, if we can go right back to the beginning, your childhood in Manchester and those sort of, I guess, those dreams that we've all had that go from almost playground to being a professional. How, you know, how was it for you growing up and making your way in the professional game?
Yeah, well, I was brought up in an area of South Manchester called Woodhouse Park, and I was actually born in my grandmother's house, which is in Openshaw, which is now a sort of 2 or 3 minute walk from where City's ground is now, you know, the Etihad Stadium. And then my parents moved to Withenshaw to a council estate, and that's where I was brought up, basically. I attended school at St. Anthony's Primary School, a Roman Catholic primary school. And, you know, I played for the school team. We had two incredible teachers who were also responsible for coaching and selecting the Manchester Boys under-11s team. A lad called Des Murphy, or not a lad, he was my sort of English teacher, but he, Des Murphy and Paul Bell, both of them, in the days when, you know, I suppose teachers performed more than just one role of teaching in the classroom, and they organised team training sessions and everything after the you know, after school, and we entered into the Manchester Schools sort of under-11s competition. In those days, there were about 330 teams in the competition, and we ended up winning it. We beat another Catholic school called St Clair's, which is from North Manchester. And if you remember Eamon O'Keefe, who played for Everton, he actually played for St. Clair. So we're from the same era, if you like. And he was the sort of superstar there. They had a couple of other lads who went on to join Manchester United's sort of academy, as it was then, or like schoolboy teams. So they were a good side as well. But we managed to win that. And then when I was actually coaching at Manchester City's academy, so this would be probably 40 years later, maybe 40 years later, we had a young lad at our academy who was also captain of St. Anthony's sort of under-11s team. They got to the final of the Manchester Schools competition, and that was the last time that feat was achieved, was when I was playing. So the headmaster asked me to go to a dinner to sort of congratulate the team on, and I was only too delighted to go. But then I found out at the dinner that now there were about 38 teams that competed in that competition. Whereas, you know, in days gone by, there were 300 nods. So practically every sort of school, every primary school would have competed in the competition when I was a lad. And now, you know, due to the decline of the English Schools FA or whatever, you know, the numbers are now much more limited. So it's a bit of a disappointment to find out that, you know, there's been a decline, maybe because, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but a lot of male teachers have disappeared from the scene. And at primary school now, there's a lot of female teachers, possibly their main interest isn't football, you know, so... And also the development of academies, you know, which has sort of taken priority for all the best players. So maybe schools don't feel that they want to run football teams without the best players available, you know. But for whatever reason, schools football seems to have deteriorated of late.
It's funny. I feel like we've been working together forever. I've just written two questions for Paul and Stephen. First question was about the role of the PE teacher or the role of the sports teacher, Paul, sort of, you know, way back when, you know, when we were at school and how the sort of PE teacher, certainly like you said before, the academies, was arguably the most influential role in a, certainly in a young boy's life, or certainly a young boy's life who was interested in playing football.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Paul, do you want to
take that? No, it's okay, Jim.
Okay. When I went to, it was a grammar tech school. I wasn't bright enough to get to the school that I wanted to. I wanted to go to St. Bede's or Xaverian, which were the two main Catholic grammar schools in the Manchester area. I didn't have good enough results to go there, so I ended up going to a grammar tech school in Sharston called St. Augustine's, and we had a sportsmaster there called Denny Howells, who was unbelievably superb and supportive of you know, any team sport, really. So we had successful rugby teams. We were good at basketball. We were good at football, you know, and that was down to the head of PE, this chap, Denny Howells, and he was the headmaster at the grammar school. Was Monsignor McGuinness. He was a rugby man, really. He was an intelligent, you know, it was more important for him to promote sort of getting good A-level results and O-level results than it was for anybody to compete for the town team, you know, at football or rugby or whatever. But his priority was rugby. And, you know, I was invited to play for Manchester Boys. And he actually originally wasn't going to allow me to play for Manchester Boys because he didn't think it was the right thing for a player from our school to get involved with. There was a lad called Terence Healy who was a good rugby player. He was allowed to play for Manchester Boys rugby team. And, you know, we just felt as a family, myself, my mum and my dad, that it was a bit of an unfair treatment of a young footballer. So my dad went and he interviewed with the headmaster. We ended up changing his mind, but largely due to Denny Howells, who was, like I say, totally supportive of progressing young players. By that time, sort of when I was about 13, I used to play for a team called West Park Albion. West Park, because we played at Windsor Park, we got through to the semi-final of a tournament, and it was in North Manchester. And I actually played in this game. Unbeknown to me, there was a chap called Harry Godwin, who was a very well-known, renowned scout for Manchester City. He was a chief scout at City. He lived in North Manchester and he was watching this particular game. I didn't know at the time that he was there, but at the end of the game, he approached our manager, a fellow called Desro, and he asked if he could have a word with me, and he wanted to come and speak to my dad. So this was on the Sunday. On the Monday night, he turned up at my house in Woodhouse Park. My dad wasn't in. He was down at the pub, a pub called the Cock of the North at the end of the road. And so Harry... Harry Godwin walked down to the pub, had a couple of pints with my dad, invited me down to train on a Tuesday and a Thursday evening, as we did then. Now, of course, Phil Foden will have attended St. Bede's school where I wanted to go. He'll attend school in the morning, then he'll come and train with the City coaches in the afternoon, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then play on Sunday. So, you know, what is available for the development of young players now is unbelievable in comparison with what was available to us. We used to train with two senior coaches, Fred Nielsen and Dick Nielsen, sorry, Dick Nielsen and Fred, and they used to pick the what was the Lancashire B team and the A team in those days. The B team was sort of under 16 and the A team was under 18. But I was only 13 and I was training with these lads after school. I used to cycle down from Sharston to Cheadle Town where we used to train. And then I'd cycle back after, and then I'd have to do my homework. Like, you know, so it was blinking hard work for me to go to these training nights. But I absolutely loved it. And the thing was, I was only young, I was only small, and I didn't get lots of opportunities to play in the games at the end of the training session. I did all the running up and down the little stand at Cheadle Town and, you know, the ball work and stuff, but I was too small to really sort of play in the games. And I got disillusioned with that. So I decided to leave at that point. And then when I decided to stay on and take A-levels, I got selected for Manchester Boys under-18s team. I was 17 at the time, and we were playing against Ayrshire Boys at the Manchester County Ground at Brantingham Road. And Harry Godwin was there. And by this time, of course, I'd shot up in the 4 years, not particularly filled out any. I was still a wiry little thing, like a little bit like Phil Foden, you know, and his development, although he was a much, much better player than I was. And I actually then got a second bite of the cherry, if you like, and I was lucky enough to be invited down again. The day I went to Main Road into the first team dressing room, which was, I mean, I was a City fan, so to actually be there, and then Joe Mercer and Malcolm Allison were sitting there, they just got out of the bath, they had nothing on, nothing on, and I'm like, I was petrified, I've got to say, even though I was, you know, I was 17, and although I might even be getting those, like when I was 13 and when I was 7, I might be getting those two eras sort of confused a little bit, but I'm 67 now, so that's allowed, you know what I mean? So I ended up, Mal took me out on the pitch, and you know, he had me running up and down with the ball at my left foot, and he giving me little tips about, you know, you've got to use your right foot as well, which I never ever took that advice on. And that was it. So you know, I by that time, of course, I'd had a couple of offers from from polytechnics. Because again, I didn't get good enough A-level results to go to Oxbridge or where I wanted to go. So I had an offer from Kingston upon Thames and an offer from Leeds Polytechnic. And of course, in the meantime, then I get this invitation to go and train and play for Manchester City's A team. So I decided to go to Leeds because I knew I'd be travelling home at weekend to play the games. And that was it. So I went to Leeds Polytechnic, and I used to travel home on a Friday afternoon because we didn't have lectures Friday afternoon. My mum and dad owned a pub, so I used to work on the bar Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday lunch. I used to go training on Monday morning, which was a physical day. So we used to go to Windsor Park, and we'd do they had an athletics track there, and we used to do 440s, 220s, 150s, 100 metres. It was a running morning, and of course there were people there then like Colin Bell, and if you remember Colin Barrett, Frank Carradus, Alan Oakes, all really good runners. I was a good runner, but in comparison with these like good physical specimens, I was just a bit of a weedy student, really, you know. But it was a fantastic education for me, that, and it allowed me to, you know, sort of be around people at the club on the Monday morning. Then on Monday afternoon, I used to get the train to Leeds, do my lectures. I mean, it was all right for them. They were training, running the nuts off, and then going home to sleep, you know, on Monday afternoon. Me, I had to go and do my lectures, so... So it was another hard life for me, like, but But I loved combining the two. And then on a Wednesday afternoon, I used to play for the law department team in an interdepartmental polytechnic sort of league, if you like. That was the extent of my sort of training programme, if you like, until I was encouraged to sign full-time. But I'd always promised my mum. My mum was the sort of educationalist in the family. My dad would have had me signing for City, you know, as soon as I got out of nappies, really. But my mum always encouraged me to complete my education. And as long as I passed my exams at the end of each year, I decided that I'd carry on to complete the law degree and then see what happened at the end. I'd never been offered a contract while I was still at university, although there was a director at Manchester City called Chris Muir, who was in charge of youth. And he said, sort of indicated that even at this age of about sort of 18, 19, he said that Everton had shown interest in wanting to take me to Goodison. And so they'd had the same problem with Steve Highway when he was a student, and he ended up leaving City and going playing for Halewood or Hales Owen or someone's like a non-league, you might know, but it was a non-league team anyway, a good non-league team.
Yeah, Skelmersdale United, I think it was.
Skelmersdale is right, yeah. So City missed out on him, and then he went to Liverpool after he'd been at Skelmersdale for a while. So they didn't want the same thing to happen to me, and I'd leave City and then end up at Everton maybe or another club. So they offered me a sort of a semi-pro contract where they paid me expenses to come back from Leeds each weekend. And then, you know, sort of, I got a few bob for that. And then I worked on the bar at my dad's pub, so I got a few bob for that. So I was quite lovely as a student, really. I wasn't too badly off. But, I'm glad that the progress took the route that it did, because I think if people had have had to make a decision on me at the age of 17, they probably wouldn't have considered me for City's first team. Whereas being involved at the Poly, coming home, having a little bit of time away, you know, allowed me the opportunity to develop and, you know, allowed City to develop me the way they wanted to do that. So, it really worked out for me. But there were a lot of sort of educated footballers, and Steve Highway, I've just mentioned. Brian Hall was another one. They were like Big Bamba and Little Bamba at Liverpool, weren't they? Steve Coppell, was an intelligent, well-educated lad. So there were quite a few players around that had gone to university and got a degree and now were playing football, you know. So, but I'd never actually played for the first team while I was at university. I'd played lots of reserve team games but I'd never played for the first team. So I was a little bit dubious as to whether it was going to work out, even when I signed my first contract. And the manager then was Tony Bucklack, you know. So my first contract was for £35 a week, which I'd have probably been better off studying for law, I think.
I mean, Stephen, I'll come to you next, because, you know, you and I have both got kids at various ages there at schools. And this might need to be a two-part podcast. I'm just preparing everyone for this. It might be really long, but we'll split into two parts, which is brilliant. But see, you know, we've both got kids at school, and when you listen to Paul Ware and the development, the pathway, the progression of his career, and the critical role that school played, and now you look at certainly within football now, and you look at it, and the part school plays now is almost negligible before the academies not necessarily swoop in, but it's very much, you know, school is no longer at the forefront of a young person's sort of sporting career or ambition.
Yeah.
So certainly at primary school age, I know of none of it. My three kids have gone through primary school. The youngest one still is, and they've never, you know, run a football team at all. High school, different matter. You know, it's a broader spectrum. Broader span of teachers, mix of gender, and yes, you know, there's opportunities at high school, but yes, there can be a reluctance for some players to be allowed to play. I've known of school instances where some of the best players are not allowed to play for the schools and, you know, they're cocooned and protected.
Yeah, can I come in there, Stu, as well? I mean,
yeah, go ahead, Paul.
I mean, going back to what Paul was saying, what Stephen said as well, I mean, my first teaching job was in 1977. I started at St. Wolfe's in Liverland and Liverpool. Every Saturday morning, we had 9 teams playing in the Merseyside Block League, and we all met in the morning. We're all young male teachers, all in our 20s. We all had our own team. We all played, we had five teams playing at home, 4 teams playing away. And it was just a fabulous bonding experience for the kids and for the teachers as well. Slowly but surely, the Saturday morning football kind of declined. And then, as Stephen's indicated there, you got to the situation where certain academies wouldn't let the kids play for the school team. And then therefore, playing for the school team ceased to be the honour it was when I was a kid. And I think that's a real shame as well. And I think what I've noticed, you know, the school's recent is, I think there's more attention to girls' football at the moment. I think there's certainly more of the female staff getting into developing girls' football. And to some extent, the boys' football at school level, I'm just a little bit concerned about how it's going, because, you know, most Saturday mornings in the late 70s, any sort of park in Liverpool was full of school teams playing each other. You know, me and Paul mentioned about 300 schools in the primary school competition. It was like that in Merseyside. But, you know, as the years have gone on, the lack of people being prepared to give up their time and also feeling that maybe they're not being appreciated for that has really caused, you know, a bit of a decline in the value of schoolboy football.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I do partly agree that it is a shame. But, you know, we sort of learned a little bit from, and this was another role that I had to play when I finished coaching at Everton and I went working for the PFA. And I was asked by Gordon Taylor to set up a sort of a working group, which was involved in improving youth football in England, you know, and looking into some of the problems that we had. So, as you said, I mean, Ryan Giggs, when he was playing for sort of Salford Boys and Manchester United Academy and the Welsh Boys, or I think he actually played for England Boys as a schoolboy. Yeah. And he was playing like 120 games a year, a season, you know, whereas you draw comparisons from clubs abroad like Auxerre, Ajax in Holland. The lads just played for their particular club. The clubs took responsibility for the development of the best young players. And I think, you know, that's what's happened now with the introduction of academies. So, you know, the likes of Phil Foden, he's been coached by top quality coaches from being the age of 6. He was at City when he was 6. And there's also lots of theories about, you know, the number of hours that you practice improves you, you know, before you become professional. You have to do 10,000 hours practice. And, you know, the old school system wasn't geared around practice. It was geared around playing games, you know. So, and you don't, it's not always a learning environment when you're playing games all the time. So I do feel that now, I mean, I look at the results for young England teams, you know, we're right up there all the time. The under 17s, under 19s, under 21s. You know, we've got this basis of learning, and you know, we've spent time developing the skills and the practices to be able to compete with the Southern Europeans, like the Spanish and the Italian teams, you know, and at international level. I think since the introduction of academies, you know, we've developed technically much better players. But then
can I just ask, Paul, do you think, so, you know, obviously when you look at school and the role school played and how obviously school captured pretty much every single young boy, do you think that obviously the new system and the sort of the impact that academies now have and the reach that they have, do you think the new system is more effective at finding players, or do you think more players get missed because it's not so much the preserve of schools and it's more a reliance on the clubs identifying talent?
I would be very, very surprised if Manchester City didn't know who the best 10 players were in the greater Manchester area. And I'm not talking about Manchester. I'm talking about Rochdale, Oldham, Bury, all that surrounding area. Even getting into United territory, into Trafford Boys, and you know the city coaching staff the recruitment staff will know where the best players are. Trouble. I mean, when Phil Foden was six, everybody runs academy sessions for young players. Sort of six. They're not allowed to sign for the club until they are nine on the, sort of their eighth birthday. So under nines level. But from the age of six, and I do believe that at the moment in Manchester City's academy there are four-year-olds, right? Which you might not be able to believe that. But I'm sure Maradona would have been fantastic when he was four. And, you know, it's everybody's job to find out who these best players are and get them on board at the club as soon as they can. Phil Foden was visiting Liverpool's academy maybe on a Monday night, Everton's on a Tuesday, City on a Wednesday, Man United on a Friday. He was keeping his options open, and quite rightly so. You know, he'd be looking at which club he felt was the best club to develop him and his talents. And at the age of eight, we had a real struggle on our hands to keep him at the club, really. And I spoke with his dad. His dad actually was a City fan, and he said, "Don't worry about anything, Paul." He says he's going to sign for Manchester City. So I told the recruitment officer that news, and it's a fellow called Barry Poynton, who was a scouser. Barry used to work for Everton before he came to City, and that was the best news that we could have provided for the club, because Phil Foden was the best young player at his age group, through every age group, going right the way through under 11s, under 14s, under 16s. He was the best player in the Northwest, and there are a lot of good players in the Northwest. So that is a tremendous feat for City to keep him, for him to choose City for his development, and I think also latterly for Pep Guardiola to handle him the way that he has done, give him opportunities without giving him opportunities too quickly and allowing his head to swell. You know what I mean? Not that he would, because he's a down-to-earth sort of lad. And I think he'll be living in a bigger house now than the house I went to visit him when he was 8 years of age. I'm sure, but good luck to him because he's a really good lad.
Stephen, I'll come to you, because again, this is it's something we've kind of touched on before, and again, it's something that interests me. I kind of see it a little bit where I live in Hull, but obviously, you know, with you being a passionate Liverpool fan, and I'll ask Paul, being a big Everton fan as well, the same question in a minute. Are you aware of young players, you know, sort of in Hull, and you know, Paul just mentioned it there about, you know, Manchester City being aware of the best players in Hull, which is a relatively small city that's right on the edge of the country. Nobody comes and nobody leaves, so you're quite well aware of the talented young players in and around the sort of East Yorkshire area at the different age groups. Does that still apply at big clubs like Liverpool as well?
Yes, it does. You know, the word breaks through, you know, of a young talent that's ripping it up, basically, and putting the performances in and showing all the promise in the world. They don't always make it, but, you know, that buzz of anticipation over the talent of a young player, it does, you know, filter through.
And is that the same at Everton, Paul, as well? Is that the same, you know, do you get... Because obviously, you know, Liverpool and Everton are so close. You know, I'm guessing you and Stephen may well be aware of the same boys, I guess.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think Stephen's summed the situation perfectly there. But both clubs are well aware of who the talented youngsters are coming through, not only on Merseyside but further afield as well. And it's always good to hear the buzz about these young players coming through, because you know, I mean, in the case for Paul with Phil Foden, the Man City, to get a local lad whose family support the club to get them to sign for your club is superb. And you know, the more, I've always been a strong believer that there should be, at least even these days, at least one or two local players making it through to the first team. I just think it binds us to the identity of the club a little bit more. And I just think, you know, particularly always this old school style of thought that in derby matches you should have at least one local player playing for one of the teams. It just adds a bit more to it for me. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I used to deal with, you know, with some of the academy scouts who come into school, and you know, would be speaking to young boys getting to sign up for the team, and certainly the package that was being offered improved over the years, and certainly, you know, certainly at the start of this century, the care and guidance and support that was put in was so far removed to what it was like when Paul was a footballer coming through the system. And I think, you know, that's been reflected in the quality of footballers that we're producing now, who maybe wouldn't reach those levels under the old system.
Yeah. I mean, when I was working at the PFA, and I mentioned about this group of coaches that were making suggestions about improving the standard of coaching, what's available, the facilities for young players in the English game. And I mean, there were people on this. I mean, I was just the errand boy, really, because we had Howard Kendall was sitting on there. There was Dave Sexton, Don Howe, all top coaches. It was my job to go over to different countries in Europe, really. So I actually met Gerard Houllier, and he was head of the French FA at the time, the French coaching arm of the FA. He took me to Auxerre. He took me to Auxerre, which was the epitome of looking after young players, looking after their education and the football education all together. They all lived together. They went to school together in the morning. They trained in the afternoon. So much the system that is involved now in the English game. Ajax were exactly the same. Ajax had players that had played for them, top players, international players that had played for Holland, who were coaching these players during the afternoon and after school, you know, whereas in England that didn't tend to happen. In fact, you know, there was a chap called Charles Hughes. You probably know him. You probably know him, Paul. And he was in charge of the development of players. Most of his staff were from a teaching background. Hey, all good people, by the way. People like Mickey Wadsworth and you know, I've just mentioned Dave Sexton and Don Howe, who were working for the FA at the time. But what was available for young players in England was not the same as the education that was available to young players abroad. Like, you know, and I had a fantastic year. I absolutely loved that year. I went to Italy and I spoke to people at the Italian FA. I couldn't speak Italian, but Joe Jordan was at AC Milan, and he introduced me to the people that I needed to speak to. I went to Germany, where Tony Woodcock was playing for FC Cologne, and he interpreted for me, went through how long it takes a German coach to achieve his coaching qualifications. In England at the time, you could do it in 2 weeks at Lillishall. 2 weeks at Lillishall, you had the highest coaching qualification that was available to an English coach. So, you know, there were a lot of differences. I went to Sweden, where there was a lad called Paul Balsam, who was a scientist rather than, you know, he was into the fitness coach, development of young players, something that was never involved in the English coaching qualification at all, understanding how young players develop psychologically and physically. It does now, you know, the qualifications are much, much better now. But Paul Balsam was a tremendous help to me, you know, and we went to speak to people from the Swedish FA when Sweden had a really good side, you know, and I learned a lot everywhere I went. I learned things, you know, and it was great to put this report together in the end. But like I say, I was just the errand boy. I used to come back and provide this evidence for all these coaches, and they would sort of say, yeah, we recommend that. We don't like that so much. And in the end, we got together a report that was presented to Doug Ellis, was the top man at the FA at the time, and he was really supportive of the report. It was sent to the chairman of every football league club. It involved all the leagues, not just the first division as it was then. It was making comparisons with what a youth coach's job was at Stockport County and at Carlisle. And, you know, it was a really enjoyable year. And really, Howard Wilkinson took over. Howard Wilkinson was appointed head of coaching after Charles Hughes left the FA, and things started to change a little bit when Howard was involved. But what is available now for young players is unbelievable in comparison with what was.
I mean, I'll come to you, Paul. McPalm again. You look at Howard Wilkinson, and again, he comes from that education background, and to me, looking at sort of not the biggest change in the game, you know, obviously the people far more qualified than I am, but it seems that the education, be it, you know, whether it's sports science based, whether it's data analysis, whether it's emotional intelligence, whatever it is, you know, it still seems that the education is still a key fundamental in the development, not only the development of players, but also in the development of coaches who are responsible for the development of players.
Yeah, I'd agree, Stuart. I mean, the point that Paul made there as well, like you could get a coaching qualification within 2 weeks. It's just absolutely bizarre. And as you know, one of my friends did that. He did a two-week course. I'll tell you how good he was at football. On his teaching practice, he had the kids playing on a hockey pitch because he hadn't realised it wasn't a football pitch. He hadn't played there for 2 weeks on a hockey pitch. And at the end of the teaching practice, the kids said, that was a great idea to get us to play on a smaller pitch. We really improved our skills by doing that. He hadn't even realised he'd made the mistake in doing that. And certainly in the 70s and 80s, my recollection was always looking out the staff room, seeing a pitch caked in mud on a cold, dark night, and 11v11 with a heavy ball kicking it from one end to the other, and that constituted the training session from the member staff in charge. And that's not criticising the member staff in charge, it's just they didn't have the wherewithal or the capabilities to be able to add. I mean, they weren't doing football men, and you know, it's like an end of the walk of life, you know. I mean, when you're doing your law degree, Paul, you'd look asking sort of like a painter and decorator to come in and run a few sessions for you. You're looking for a specialist in that particular area. And I think the one big advantage of the academy system, from my point of view, is that I mean, I love that idea about, you know, the Dutch players, you know, playing for the club one day, coaching the youngsters next. That sounds superb. I think the only slight reason I still have with the academy system would be, I think sometimes because the children get picked up at such a young age, when they get dropped by the club, say 13, 14, still don't have an overinflated sense of where they should be playing football. So quite often you speak to a kid who's been dropped by, say, Liverpool, Everton, Man United, Man City, and you say, well, if he thought about Wigan, I thought about Tranmere, I thought about Southall, oh, I'm not playing for a team like that, oh, no, I wouldn't play for somebody like that. Some of them are clever enough to realise, hang on, given my background here, I can go and make it at a different level and maybe come back and make it at the top level. And it's brilliant to see that. But some of them get lost to the game, 15, 16. I mean, I think maybe that was always the case anyway, but I don't quite know how you get around that.
You see, I've got to say, if the player and the parents are thinking that way, they probably won't be successful anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they've not got the same mental attitude to what is necessary to achieve success.
Yeah, I think you said that, Paul, the parents, I think, are hugely influential with that, because I think sometimes the parents always put too much hopes on their son being the warehouse of things for them.
Yeah, because he's been the top player in all his formative years, and then all of a sudden he goes to a club like Liverpool or Everton or City or United in the Northwest. And all of a sudden, he's not the best player, you know, and they have trouble adjusting to that. I'll tell you a story about a young lad who's now at Burton Albion, a lad called John Brayford, who is a Liverpool lad. He came to City and he was with us through his formative years up till about 14 or 15, and then we have to make a decision on, you know, whether we're going to keep him under 15, under 16. And then at under 16, are we going to give him a scholarship so that he becomes so that he goes to school, and then he's primarily got a good chance of being a pro footballer. And then at 18, you make a decision on whether he's going to be a pro footballer or not. And we used to do this as an academy. Our head of academy was Jim Cassell, who was a top man, because he used to give everybody a voice, you know, and an opinion. And if there were, even if there were four votes against a player and three, four, he would say, well, if you three see something in him, we'll give him a scholarship, like, you know, and it wasn't a big deal or a big risk. But with Paul Brayford, you know, he came under my remit, really, as the decision maker about his future. And I decided that he probably wasn't going to make it at Manchester City. Now, he's gone away, and because he's got a fantastic attitude and a bit of a pride in him, in his own ability, he's gone away and he's made a career out of professional football, even though it isn't at Manchester City, and he probably would never have been good enough to play for Manchester City because he'd have been there now if he was. But he's made a career out of football. But there are lots of other players that have left the club and gone to university. They've studied physiotherapy, and then they've come back to the club and worked for the club in that capacity, which, you know, there are a lot more opportunities now with the development of academy groups, you know. And like, I mean, when I was at City in the early days of academy, we had one physiotherapist for all the 135 players in the academy, you know. I mean, Tuesday and Thursday nights were like chaos with injured players. Now they've got a match analyst for each phase. So say it's nines to twelves. They have a match analyst who will watch the game and have a camera film the game so that they can talk through with the coach, you know, as individuals or as a back three, which whatever format they're going to play. They have a physiotherapist who, you know, deals with any injured players. They've got everything now. They have a sort of an educational advisor, you know, so that they've got, it's a much more holistic program now than it ever was, you know. And I think the care now for young players is absolutely second to none. Since the development of academies and with the Premier League.
I just want to ask, I'm going to ask all three of you this, because again, this is now clearly going to be in two halves. This podcast. I've already made my mind up. One half about youth football and then one half about your career, Paul. But one thing I want to ask all of you, and I'll ask you first, Stephen, what's your thoughts on children, youngsters playing a whole range of sports? I'm pretty sure that I can speak for all four of us. All four of us will pretty much have played most sports as a kid, whether it was in the park, at the school, in the street. So has, again, you know, this is not to be detrimental to the academy system, as you've said there, Paul. You know, it does a lot of great things, and it's certainly developing the young international players now very successfully. But where do you all sit on allowing children to still be able to play, you know, multi-sports? A, that they should play as, you know, as many different sports as they can, but also the benefits that that can bring, arguably to their football career, but arguably so they don't become disenfranchised with football because that's all they see day in, day out from the age of 7 or 8. You know, that variance and that opportunity to be able to play other sports. How, you know, where do you all sit on that one? Stephen, I'll ask you first.
Well, I think when we were kids, you know, football did tend to stop in May and it would, you know, start up again at the end of July or, you know, in mid-August sometimes. There would be a defined 3-month switch off where we all went down the field and, you know, swung a cricket bat around, or, you know, someone would have a tennis racket and you go to the local park and, you know, everyone, for 2 weeks of Wimbledon, everyone wants to play tennis for a bit. So, you know, you would have these periodical, you know, shifts of kind of like sporting interest. You know, I played football at school levels to a reasonable level, and I always felt that, you know, other sports helped in that, you know, just certain movements that were translatable from one sport to another. A certain way that you would watch a ball come towards you, you know, in certain sports, the ball will come at you a lot faster playing tennis or cricket than it would do at football. So when a football travels to you at a slower speed, you know, your response was completely different. You know, I found that my control of the football, you know, was helped greatly by playing other sports. Just, you know, kicking a tennis ball around was one on the playground, playing football with a tennis ball. you know, playing with a tennis ball in a small area. You know, your levels of control. I mean, the notorious kind of like the box at Anfield where Shankly would have the players hitting the ball against the boards, ricocheting and coming back and stuff like that. You know, it's all things that have been transferable to you know, the modern game. I know, you know, Jurgen Klopp's Borussia Dortmund and all of that, you know, used to have a more scientific version of that. But yes, you know, I'm you know, a great believer that, you know, I improved as a footballer by playing different sports just because of that sense of coordination. You know, the tests that you were given in receiving a ball or whatever it was, you know, were always translatable to football. But, you know, whether that is still the case now, I couldn't tell you. But football is no longer a 9-month sport. It is a 12-month sport. It is just forever switched on. 365 days a year, if people aren't playing it, thinking about it, talking about it, you know, it was never off the back pages of the newspapers. You know, as a kid, I remember football falling off the back pages unless there was a, you know, a managerial sacking or a big transfer. It would always be about cricket and golf and tennis and all of that. But football is just such a huge, huge entity now, and it always was. But at some point, there was a tipping point where it became the be-all and end-all, and all other sports were, you know, relegated to being kind of like 5-6 pages into the back pages of a sports pages of a newspaper.
Paul McPowell, you know, how, you know, your thoughts on this one, and like I say, the benefits of multi-sport for youngsters, even somebody who is, you know, an incredibly talented footballer, you know, somebody who is in with a shout of a professional career, be it Premier League, be it League Two, be it National League. You know, where do you sit on this sort of, not prevention, but still exposing them and allowing them to play multiple sports?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it's a really good idea. I think that, as Steve outlined there, there used to be a clear division over the course of the year between the football, cricket, athletics and tennis season. You know, same number when ours came and Paul's growing up, I'm sure it was the same as well. So when it got to the end of the May, you switched to playing cricket. Then he did the Wimbledon a bit. Then he did the athletics, the Olympics was on. Then he got back to the football in September. But that's kind of gone now because of, you know, football being the year-long dominant sport in the media. And I mean, certainly when I walk around locally, I very rarely see kids playing cricket around here. Whereas when I was growing up, everyone played cricket in the summer. It was just a summer sport. And whether that's the case, maybe in the more rural parts of Lancashire, I don't know whether cricket's still a big thing there or not. But certainly, you know, from my urban perspective, cricket just doesn't seem to exist in the city in the summer. You know, I was reading, I can't remember the name of the goalkeeper who said it, but one of the Premier League goalkeepers came up, played handball as a kid, and said how much playing handball helped him to develop the skills and reflexes to improve himself as a goalkeeper. And I think Steve outlined there, you can pick up different skills from other sports to enable you to be best in your own sports. I mean, I know you're into cycling, aren't you, Stuart? And like, you got Roglic, Tour de France, who came from a skiing background. Pogacar, I think, played handball as a kid when he was growing up in Slovenia. And that's an example of a small country where their top sportsmen have come through a background where they played all different sports to a higher level. So I think Steve outlined there, you can pick up things in other sports. And I think it's also good as well. I mean, I think Paul touched on this before, alternative avenues for the kids who don't make it. So someone who does make a football, if they come through a background where, say, they played rugby union, rugby league, or something similar, for, you know, at a decent level at the same time, then at least they've got an option to maybe make progress in another arena. And from a sad ages point of view, I mourn the loss of the dual footballer. I missed like of Phil Neal, who played, you know, for Lincoln City and played for Worcestershire, like Chris Balderstone, who played for Carlisle United and played for Leicestershire. You know, it's such, and the Compton brothers in the 1950s, it's so sad that we don't produce dual sportsmen anymore.
Yeah. Ian Snodding could have played for Yorkshire, you know. He ended up choosing football.
He insisted his kid was born in Yorkshire, didn't he, so he'd be able to play for the county.
It wouldn't surprise me. But it's not just other sports. I mean, gymnastics, you know, is a fantastic sport to be able to develop muscle groups for young footballers. And you know, I used to play table tennis, so your hand eye contact, you know, is developed, so it'll help you with the, you know, judging the flight of the ball, as you were saying. But in other countries like Italy and Portugal, so I found out sort of when I was on my travels, that there's a big musical element to their lifestyle. And you look at Portuguese footballers now, And they're so easy movers, you know, around the football pitch. I mean, I absolutely love Bernardo Silva, and you know, the way that they sort of control, and it's almost they move lightly across the pitch, you know. Whereas perhaps, you know, the English players and maybe the German players, I've got that, the Northern European players. When I went to Brazil, and like all the beaches have got five-a-side pitches or head tennis pitches. All the beaches, there must be 100 head tennis pitches. Well, you can't let the ball bounce on the sand because it won't bounce. So they have to take the ball early, and that develops their skill. I'm convinced it develops their skill to deal with the ball off the ground and control the ball in the air. You know, so there are a lot of elements that will go to make the perfect footballer, I'm sure.
I can't believe the opening question was just tell us about your childhood, and here we are an hour later, and we're sort of coming to terms with what makes the perfect junior footballer. I knew this is how it would be. It is absolutely brilliant. We'll move into part two, and we'll actually look at your career. You know, you've talked about, obviously, you know, sort of holding off on that pro contract. You talked about, you know, sort of, I guess, the loyalty to your mum and seeing out your university degree. But I mean, you know, the career is exceptional. It's, you know, it's all the things, or certainly a lot of the things that youngsters and as we're talking about young boys growing up can only dream of, you know, in terms of a professional football career. You know, you play for your boyhood club, you end up being captain, you know, you're scoring in the San Siro, you're playing in FA Cup finals. We'll start with the San Siro and Milan in 1978. And, you know, how do you, as a young player, because I'm always interested, absolutely fascinated by what professionals think and how they feel in certain moments. What is it like? I suppose that's the only question I've got. What is it like to be in those incredible stadiums, playing in the biggest of games?
Well, I've got to say, when we played AC Milan, and this was the great AC Milan team, you know, with the Maldinis and Bereses of this world, and we were supposed to play on the Wednesday night, the San Siro. We went out on the pitch, and you could just see flares, you know, fireworks all over the place. It was like really intimidating. You know, the stadium was absolutely packed. Then a fog descended like you wouldn't believe. You couldn't even see the centre circle. You certainly could not see the top of the stand, but you could hear them. And as I was saying, it was a really intimidating atmosphere. Anyway, the referee called the game off. So we actually played the game the following day on the Thursday afternoon. We kicked off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I think. And the people were at work, so the stadium was only half full. So the atmosphere wasn't nearly as intimidating for us. So it really worked in our favour. And then we ended up, we went 2-0 up, actually. Brian Kidd scored the first goal, and then I sort of went on a mazy run. I didn't know what I was doing at that age, and I just kept running, and I thought, oh, I'll have a shot here. But the goalkeeper, actually, I think he might have been called Albertozzi or something. Yeah. But he was involved in, I think he might have even been banned from football for accepting bribes and that, so... I think he might have had a bet going on the night that I had that shot at the goal, because I'd have saved that. You know, I'd have saved my shot. But anyway, I joked, but it went in, and that was great. And we ended up drawing that game 2-2, and then we played the second leg at Main Road, and we beat them 3-1, like, you know. So that was a real scalp for us in those days. And then, strangely enough, the next round, we went to play Borussia Mönchengladbach. And in the days when they had a real good side and a lot of German internationals were in the team, we drew. I remember Asa Hartford scored at Main Road. We drew 1-1. And then we got beat 3-1 at their place, like, you know. So that was a bit of a disappointment. But yeah, it's great. It's great when you score important goals, you know, because those are highlights of your life. My missus, it drives her mad when people say, what was the best day of your life? You know, she wants me to say the day I got married, but I usually say when I scored in the San Siro or, you know, or against Ipswich or whatever. But what it does, it guarantees if you score an important goal in your career, that people will remember you for doing that. My dad always used to talk about, he is a Welsh international player who played for City, who was in charge of the social club, Roy Clark. And my dad used to talk about a diving header that he scored in a semi-final of a FA Cup against Sunderland, I think it was. And, you know, I mean, Nobby Clark wasn't particularly renowned as a great City player, you know, during the Bert Trautman era. But everybody remembers that goal, you know, from that particular, you know, that watched the game in that particular era. And that's how I feel, you know, having scored a couple of important goals for City when I was there for like 13 years, really. Two highlights in 13 years doesn't make me a great player, but it you know, it does help to be remembered, which is nice.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.